quantities that are connected with Gaussian approximations, and also to compare these bounds that one obtains by using these techniques of integration by parts with bounds that are connected with Poisson approximations. Okay, so we are going to study, in a certain sense, in a parallel way, Poisson and Gaussian approximations for functionals of Poisson processes. Okay. And even more than a parallel, okay? So even we are going to study how Gaussian, to see at least in some examples and in some general statements, how Gaussian and Poisson approximation and Gaussian and Poisson limits can arise simultaneously in the same model. We are going to study what are the relation between the two of them, etc. Okay? So in particular, we are going to analyze, so you saw that... for instance, you saw that a very important role is very often played by a quantity that is given by the expectation of 1 minus some inner product between derivatives, in the sense, so add 1 cost operator processes that are obtained and add 1 cost operators, plus some rest. And so we are going to see how the study, how studying this kind of quantities can affect probabilistic approximation also with respect to Poisson approximation. And so just to give you a small example of the kind of phenomenon we are going to study to analyze. So consider, for instance, the following setting. So suppose that you have a collection yi of iid random variables that are with values, let's say with values in Rm, for some m greater or equal to 1, and that are distributed according to the same absolutely continuous distribution with a density f which is bounded, continuous, and everything that makes things work. Okay, so we can see if you consider a finite number of these points, then we can see them as a random configuration of points in the plane. Okay, so now assume that you have consider also a Poisson process. So let's say on the real line, so nt. T that is greater or equal to 0, which is stochastically independent of the collection y of random variables. Okay, and then starting from the.
This is a test of the emergency warning system.
Okay.
This is only a test. If this had been an actual emergency, additional instructions would follow. This is only a test.
Okay. Let me also consider a sequence Tn of positive real numbers that are converging to zero at some speed. Okay, so starting with all these datas, for every n, I'm going to construct the Poissonized Gilbert graph, which is associated with the radius Tn. Okay, so for every n, now I'm going to define the graph Gn, so which is Vn and En, such that the vertices of this graph are given by the points y1 up to y to n of little n. So this is a Poissonized version, so a Poisson independent number of the points. And then, of course, it's really the typical one. 2 points, yy and yj, are connected if and only if their Euclidean distance, yy minus yj, is between 0 and tn, strictly. Okay, so there are no loops, etc. So this is exactly the Gilbert graph that Poissonized input random configuration of points. Then I'm going to consider 2 quantities. Okay, so the first quantity, let's say, is xn0. I'm going to count 2 things. So xn0 is, for instance, the number of edges of the graph. Okay, so I'm going to consider the number of edges in the graph gn. And then I can consider another quantity, xn of 1, and then is the number of triangles, for instance, in gn. Okay, so I can count 2 things separately. Okay, so I can count whatever subgraph I want, as long as it is feasible. And you know, since Tn is divergent to 0, so what happens now is that as n goes to infinity, I'm adding more and more points to the graph, well, because I'm discovering more and more points of this random configuration, and Tn goes to 0. So there are many things that can happen whenever I want to count something. Either Tn goes to 0 very, very slowly, and therefore all the subgraphs that I'm counting are adding one side to the other in very, very quickly, in such a way that if I renormalize things, then I obtain a central limit theorem. Or Tn can go to 0 very, very quickly, in such a way that all the edges are erased very quickly, in such a way that everything converges to 0, for instance, in L1. Or there can be some intermediate regime. Also, Tn can go to 0 in such a way that things are not exploding, but the number of subgraphs that I'm counting are converging in some strong sense, like, for instance, total variation towards some Poisson random variable. Okay? So this is really the starting point of the study of a Gilbert graph. This is chapter 2 in Matthew Penrose's book about random graphs. Okay, one interesting remark is that I can now fix a regime. Now I'm counting two subgraphs, edges and triangles. So now I can fix a sequence Tn in such a way that the two non-trivial regimes, the Gaussian one and the Poisson one, emerge simultaneously. So in this sense, if I choose Tn to be equal to this, these are values in Rm, so it is the mth root of t to of n, I'm sorry, to the power n minus n to the power minus 3 over 2, then what happens is that with this regime, we have that the number of edges, so it will be x tilde n 0, which is xn 0 minus the expectation of xn 0 over the variance of xn 0 to the power 1/2 converges in distribution to a Gaussian n 0 1 random variables, whereas the number of triangles converges to a Poisson random variable simultaneously at the same time. Okay, so you have that x1 converges in a strong sense, the distribution converges in total variation to a Poisson random variable with some parameter lambda that one can specify exactly. I mean, everything is completely explicit and very well known. Now, if you do all the computations, then there are very, very well understood and well-described theory that allows to compute moments, covariances, and variances. So you see that these two random variables, x tilde and 0, x and 1, are asymptotically non-correlated. Okay, so this is something with one computation. So there is a question which is a little less trivial, that is the following. So are xn tilde 0 and xn 1 asymptotically independent, which is stronger than not correlated. Asymptotically independent. Okay, so are there a way to see how this number of edges, or normalized number of edges and number of triangles, is asymptotically independent at the end? So the answer will be positive, okay, and will be one corollary of the things I'm going to explain to you today. And also we can ask, so at what speed? So if yes, at what speed this convergence, this asymptotic independence takes place, okay? How far they are going to be asymptotically independent, the two of them. Okay, very good. So in order to do that, I'm going to study, so in order to accomplish this kind of task, so I'm going to study in a sort of a parallel way, normal and Poisson approximation, and therefore, and also mixed convergence. That is, convergence that involves both a normal and a Poisson limit at the end. Okay, so... in which sense? I mean,
no, it's ergodic, partially ergodic. So the mean number of edges and triangles converges to constants.
No, no, no. Oh, I'm sorry?
It's not from a Lewis
spatial. No. It's converging to random variable, distribution. It's converging distribution. This is a convergence. Okay, when I see total variation here, I mean total variation in the sense of distribution. So the total variation of the... Okay. So this is really a true probabilistic limit theorem. Okay. So in order to do that, to accomplish this task, I'm going to study there for normal approximation. I'm going to review a little something. So normal approximation, and on the other hand, Poisson approximations. Okay, Poisson approximation, and I'm going to see the relation, to study the relation between the two of them. Okay. So let's start with normal approximations. And just to review a little, so since it's the tutorial, I'm going to go through some details connected with Stein's method a little more with respect to what we did before. I think this is good for the audience. So let's start with normal approximations and also the general framework. Okay. So the general framework is the same that we saw in several occasions during this talk. So the framework is the following. We consider a Poisson measure, eta, on some measurable space. So if you want really to avoid all kind of technical difficulties, you can consider this as a Polish space, for instance. And you can consider a Borel measure on this space, which is the intensity of eta. So with intensity, or control measure, mu, and you can take this is a Borel measure, which is with no atoms, okay? So with no atoms. So this means that if you consider two disjoint regions of two disjoint subset of capital X, then the number of points in these two disjoint regions is going to be given by two independent random variables, and these two independent random variables have a Poisson distribution, each one having a parameter which is equal to the measure mu of the region. Okay, the region. So this is really a Poisson measure on a general space. So I'm going to write eta hat for the compensated version. So is eta minus mu. Okay. And the point of view that we have developed in several papers is that it is a good idea, not the only idea, but it is sometimes it's a very, very good idea to look at random variables that are square integrable functionals of eta by considering what one calls their Wiener-Itô decomposition. That means that every random variable can be decomposed as a series of multiple integrals with respect to eta hat of increasing order. And on this decomposition, this is a unique decomposition with several nice properties that Gunther has explored yesterday. And using this Kautig decomposition, one can define formally and then interpret in a trajectorial way several operators that are quite useful for our computations. The result is the following. So we have the Wiener-Itô decomposition that tells you that for every random variable f, which is a square integrable functional of your original Poisson measure, you can write f as the sum of its expectation plus a series which is converging in square mean of multiple integrals of the type INFN. Okay? And so then maybe the simplest way for describing a multiple integral of this type is to say that, okay, fn is a symmetric function that is square integrable with respect to with respect to the measure mu of n, and in of fn can be interpreted as the integral over x n times, okay, of the kernel, so this is nth integral, so n times of a kernel fn x1 xn that is integrated therefore with respect to n times the product sign measure eta hat, okay, so dxn. And so this, if you take fn, that is a simple function, like for instance which has support in a set that has finite measure, which is constant over square. So this is really defined omega by omega. Well, it's not a probabilistic object. It's just an omega by omega object that is defined by using measure theory and by using the fact that for every omega, eta hat is a signed measure, well, which a component which is a point measure and the other component which is mu, and so it's a signed measure we can integrate. And the idea, however, is that you cannot just simply integrate this function fn x1 xn, but you have to integrate by making sure that you are avoiding the diagonals. This is a very important thing. Whenever y is different from j, so the coordinate x, y, x, j must be different. Whenever there is a diagonal, you have to cut it away. And this is not a trivial operation, because having a point measure component, this sign measure eta hat, so charges every diagonal in a non-trivial way with the points. Okay, so it's really you can just build your integral by keeping the diagonals, and you eliminate the diagonals in this way. And there is a tight connection between this object of this type, so between the collection of all objects of this type, and the a multivariate collection of polynomials that are called the Charlier polynomials. Okay. So, and indeed, if you take Fn to be a function with a special structure, like for instance a product of indicator of sets that are disjoint or not, you can always represent multiple integrals in terms of linear combination of Charlier polynomials of this type. So these are really, the Charlier polynomials are, in dimension one, for instance, are the orthogonal polynomials of the Poisson distribution. Okay, so these are multidimensional objects that generalize, as I told you already in the previous talk, the properties of this. Yeah. You can assume it, but you can avoid this. To have this representation, I think it is safe to is better to assume that it is diffuse. But you can go a step further, and indeed you can put atoms in this measure. But then in this way, this interpretation in terms of integral is a little more tricky because you have more points, more diagonals. Okay, so there is a nice formula. Let me recall you this formula, which is a formula by Last and Penrose, and it's really, it already played a role yesterday. And it tells you the following. It tells you that now, if you have a random variable f, and if you define the following operator, so if you define dx of f of eta as being equal to f of eta plus delta x minus f of eta, which is the add one cost operator, and then you continue like this. So you define d of n as d of dn minus 1 of n recursively in such a way that you obtain a function in n variables, then you can always, assume that you have this, then you have always the conclusion that the kernel fn that appears in this decomposition is equal to 1, so fn of x1 xn is always given by 1 over n hat, an factorial, then the expectation of dn of f x1 xn. So, and I confess it took me a couple of weeks in order to understand how useful this formula he is and how different it is from the one that exists in the Gaussian case. Because the theorem, the result by Last and Penrose, tells you that if you have a function like this, f, then automatically this kernel, which is not necessarily, in principle, is not necessarily square integrable, is not only symmetric, but also square integrable in this sense, and enters for every f directly this formula. So there is a similar formula on the Gaussian space that is called, is very well known, that is called the Struck formula. And this formula from 88 of Struck, but this formula is much less restrictive. And in order to apply the Struck formula, that is the same form, you have to assume much more regularity on capital F. Okay, but this holds for every square integrable F. So it is something that really can be used in several situations. Okay, so we have this. And then one important point is that appears, and it's already been evoked by Günther yesterday, is that multiple integrals have some isometric property. And it goes as follows. So if you consider, so this was multiple integral isometry. If you consider now the expectation of IN of F and IM of G, so you have two multiple integrals of possibly different orders, so there are two cases, either N is equal to M, and in this case, the result is non-trivial, or n is different from m, and the result is 0. And so to resume this, you have that this is equal to the indicator of n equal m. Then you have a combinatorial term n factorial. And then you can take the inner product, the scalar product of f and g in L2 mu to the power n, provided f and g are symmetric already. Okay, they are already symmetric. Of course, you can always define multiple integrals with respect to non-symmetric kernels, but since you are integrating with respect to a symmetric measure, then the integral of the function is equal to the integral of the symmetrization. So it is not a restriction to consider a symmetrization. Okay, so this is quite an important formula, the isometric formula, which is something that gives you this isomorphism between the space of L2 sigma eta and the Fock space that was evoked yesterday in several occasions by Günther. Okay, so this is the framework. Now, you have some operators. And really here, I would like just to stick to the, at least partially, mostly on the representation on the chaotic expansion, okay? On the chaotic expansion. You have some, what one calls Malievin operators. So I'm not sure Malievin, if he was still alive, would be happy to have them, because I think he never worked on the Poisson space. But these are operators that extend the Poisson space, those that were introduced by him on the Gaussian space. Okay, so Malievin operators. And these are the following. So the first one is, the first one coincides in some sense with the ad one cost operator that I wrote here. Okay, so this is the Malievin derivative. And it goes as follows. So you start with a function f that has an expansion of the chaotic expansion, so expectation plus the sum n going from 1 I n fn. And then this operator transforms. You take a function of this type, and this operator transforms a random variable in a random function, and so it goes as follows. So dx of f is defined as the expectation of f plus the sum for n going from 1 to infinity of n. Then you eliminate one order of integration, and you keep one variable free, which is the one that gives you the dependence on x in the definition. Okay. So this definition makes sense. So this is an infinite series. So this must converge in some proper sense. And so in order for this definition to make sense, you must have that. So provided this series here converges in the, so this the series of the of the of the norm of Fn converges in some strong sense. And the strong sense is the following. So you must have that n times n factorial, and then the norm of Fn squared is converging. Okay. And observe that by isometry, the variance of f is equal to the sum of n factorial times fn square. Okay? If you apply the isometry, this is given the variance. Okay? So we are asking more here. And by the way, in the Gaussian case, in order to apply the Struck formula, which is the equivalent of the last Penrose formula, you must have that this converges for n to the power k for every integer k, okay, which is really much, much more. Okay, so, and there is a result, which is quite well known, by Noalart and Viv, from 89, I think, that tells you that if, that indeed, for f of, so that, so let's say, let's call star this condition here, so let's say that this result tells you that if star is verified, then dx of f defined in this way is equal to the ad one cost operator. So you can interpret it as an ad one cost operator. Okay. It equals, so the ad one cost operator. Okay. So there are two more operators that I want to introduce once again. One is called L. L, and it is defined as follows, as L of f is an operator that takes a random variable f with this decomposition, and transform it in the sum for n greater than 1 of 1 over n, and then, n times I n of fn. Okay? So it is something that amplifies the fluctuation and the larger scale of the chaotic decomposition. Okay. So in order to do that, so provided the series of n square n times fn square is converging. Okay, so you need even something more than the other. And then you have a third operator. So this is called the generator. I will come back later to this. So L minus 1 of f, on the other hand, is given. So it is the pseudo inverse, and it is given by this by multiplying each projection on the chaos by minus 1 over n. So it is called the pseudo operator because L minus 1 of F is equal to L minus 1 of F minus the expectation. It's still inverse, because it doesn't take the expectation into account. Okay, so now an interesting remark. So there are two important results, so two facts that are quite important that we are going to use in the following, that are, the first one is that, okay, L is a generator. Okay, L, this operator here, is a generator of a semigroup. Okay, so L is fact number one. L is the generator of a semigroup. Let's say T for T greater than zero, which is called the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup on the Poisson space. And so, but everything we need to know for understanding some of the computation I'm going to do, so it's something that I described more precisely in my talk, is that TT of F has a very nice representation under the form of a conditional expectation. And this is quite important because it allows us to apply, without even thinking, Jensen inequality in a quite an important way. And TT of F can be represented as the conditional expectation of the original. So TTF of eta, okay? It's the conditional expectation of F computed in something conditionally on eta, where inside F one puts another auxiliary Poisson measure that has the same distribution at eta. And it is constructed for each T by following the rules of a birth and death process. That is, you put a random experiment at each point of eta. Then if the experiment is not successful, you just delete this point, and then you compensate what you did by adding an independent component with a correct amount of intensity that makes eta of t having the same distribution of eta. So eta t has the same distribution of eta, but it's not eta. So eta is composed by, it has, eta t has two additional components, the thinning, which is independent of everything, and the additional Poisson measure with a reduced intensity that compensates. Okay, but everything that we need to know is that inside TT of F, there is a copy of our original random variable. That is therefore that projected by conditional expectation towards something. So this is the first result. And the second result, so there is another operator in the background, which is the adjoint or D, but this is something which is quite mysterious and difficult to describe, but we don't really need delta. We just need to know that the following happens. We need to know that for every F and G, such that, let's say, F is in the domain of, G is in the domain of D, and such that the expectation of F is zero, so one is centered, and the other one is in the domain of G, that is, verifies the, of D, that is, verifies this expression, one has that the expectation of F times G, which is, of course, the covariance, is equal to the expectation of the inner product of DG, and minus dl minus 1 of f. Okay? So, this is everything we need to know. And this is not really a difficult computation, a difficult thing to prove, because since multiple integrals are dense, it is sufficient to prove this result for f and g equal to multiple integrals. And in this case, everything is very simple. Okay, so let's say, idea of the proof is that it's sufficient to take g equal to I m of little g and f equal to I n of little f, and then you can proceed by density. So in this case, dg is just equal to m I m minus 1 g of x dot, for x here, and minus d l minus 1 of f is therefore equal to d of, so what is minus l minus 1 of f is simply 1 over q, of 1 over n time the, so 1 over n I n of f. And then this derivative eliminates 1 over n, and so this is simply I n minus 1 f of x dot. Okay? Now, you know what this is. Well, in this case, you know that E of fg is just equal to the indicator of n equal to m n factorial fg. And then it's sufficient to check that the right sign coincides in this case. And then, so you have to prove that the integral in mu dx, and then you have m here, and then you have I m minus 1 gx dot I n minus 1 fx dot mu dx is equal to the same thing. But you see that if m is different from n, this is 0. And if f is equal to m, this gives you m minus 1 factorial. That times m gives you m factorial. And then you have the isometric property that gives you the same result. Okay, so this is just a very simple computation. And then you can go to the limit. You can take linear combination. It works. Then you go to the limit, because if something converges in L2, the covariance is converges, the inner products converge. So everything is... So you don't need even to know that there exists an adjoint. So it's really an isometric property that is just another way of doing this. Okay, so very good. So when did I start? At because with the light.
12 minutes
more.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so now I will go up to the to the Gaussian case, and then tomorrow we'll deal with the other one, I guess. So now let's go again a little to Stein's method, which is the one that we use for normal approximations. Okay, so the idea of Stein's method is the following. So now suppose the problem is the following. So now suppose you want to compare the distribution of two random variables. One is the Gaussian one, and the other one is given by some other random variable f. And in order to do so, you want to compare, so how to compare the expectation of h of f and the expectation of h of capital N, where h is a function which is in Lipschitz 1, and n is distributed according to an n01 distribution. Okay? So how to compare this? So you want, therefore, to have a bound on the absolute value of the expectation of h of f minus the expectation of h of capital N. Okay? So I put h of f minus h of capital N inside this one. So the idea of Stein's method is that you can replace this quantity, omega by omega, by quantity that involves smoother mappings. And so there is an intuition which is the following. So according to Stein's method, there is a Stein's lemma that tells you that a random variable x is a Gaussian N01 distribution if and only if the expectation of x fx minus f prime of x is equal to 0. And therefore this operator here, so if you take f to be the first derivative of something, this is the generator of a one-dimensional Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, which is tightly related to the normal distribution. It's not a surprise that it characterizes x in some way. So now we have, so this operator here characterizes, therefore, the Gaussian distribution. It is just something that characterizes completely the Gaussian distribution. And so we need to relate this operator here to a quantity which is inside, to the quantity which is inside this expectation. And in order to do that, Stein introduced the so-called Stein's equations. Okay, and the Stein equation is the following. So is the following. It is f prime of x minus x f of x is equal to h of x minus the expectation of h of capital N. So this is the thing that is inside the expectation, and this f here is the unknown. This is the unknown. And Okay, so there is of course a way to represent this side here as follows. This is the exponential of x squared over 2, and then the derivative, I mean the original derivative, of the exponential of minus x squared of fx. Okay, so you can represent this in this way, and x squared over 2. Okay, and therefore you can solve explicitly quite quickly this equation, and it tells you that every solution f of x can be written as some constant c multiplying x squared over 2 plus the exponential of x squared over 2, the integral from minus infinity to x, hy minus the expectation of h of capital N, the expectation of exponential of minus y squared over 2 integrated with respect to dy. Okay, so you solve this equation, and since you want that this, as x goes to infinity, f of x is negligible with respect to the Gaussian density, you have, of course, to consider only the case c equal to 0 in order to make things integrable with respect to the Gaussian distribution. And therefore, we define f of h of x. So f of h of x has been the choice with x equal to 0, which is the integral from 0 to infinity, x multiplied by this, the exponential of minus y squared over 2, and then h of y minus the expectation of h of capital N dy. So this is fh of x. Okay, and h is in lip 1. Okay, and so, and there is a nice fact that is the following. So for whatever function in lip 1 you are choosing, you can find a uniform bounds for f prime and fh prime and fh second. Okay, and so it tells you that if h is in lip 1, and this is really an exercise in analysis, I mean this is just a deterministic thing that you study and you find out that if h is in lip 1, then f prime is bounded by 1, and f second is not necessarily everywhere differentiable, but it is a Lipschitz function with a constant less or equal to 2. Okay, so f second is in lip 2. Okay, so this f prime is in f prime h and f prime h. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's okay. Well, it was the same, but then less or equal than 2, and it is the same. It exists almost everywhere. Okay, it's almost everywhere different. F prime is almost everywhere differentiable function, and the derivative exists that is less than 2, therefore, it's a lip 2 function. Okay, and so these are uniform bounds, and this gives you, tells you the following, and therefore, in order to bound, now if you want to bound what one calls the Wasserstein one distance between some random variable at n, which is defined as the supremum for h in lip 1 of the expectation of h of f minus the expectation of h of n. So this is less or equal, therefore, by all this reasoning here, that is, you can replace h of f, that is, what is inside this expectation, by the left-hand side of the Stein equation for the choice f equal to fh. So this is less or equal than the supremum over all functions such that f prime is less than 1 and f second is less than 2 of the expectation of f of capital F minus f prime of capital F. Okay, in absolute value. Okay, and what's interesting here is that on one side, we have replaced something which is Lipschitz 1 with some quantity which is smoother, and on the other hand, capital N has disappeared. Okay, so we are now forced to consider expectation where capital N doesn't play a role anymore, because the role of capital N is now played by the operator that characterizes the Gaussian distribution. And so, now you apply Now, in order to do that, now suppose, so now assume that F as expectation 0 and F, let's say, okay, and assume that F is in the domain of capital D, okay, then F of capital F, since F is a Lipschitz function, F of capital F is also a, in the domain of capital D. Okay, so then F of capital F is also in the domain of capital D for every F in the supremum. And therefore, we can apply integration by parts. Okay, so and therefore, the expectation of F times F capital F is equal to the expectation of the inner product of DF, let's say, minus DL minus 1 of F, and times D of F of capital F. Okay, where DF of capital F is the, but of course, DZ of capital F of eta, of F of capital F of eta, is equal to F of eta plus dz minus F of eta. Okay? Now, you can put, so you can transform this expectation in this expectation, and you apply a Taylor expansion around F. You use the boundedness of the second derivative, and you just apply the triangle inequality, and you find out that for every f in the supremum, so therefore, for every f in the supremum, this expectation, the expectation, the absolute value of the expectation of f of capital F minus f prime of capital F, so it's less or equal than, so f prime is bounded by 1, so this is the expectation of 1 minus df minus dl minus 1 of f, absolute value, plus the integral over x of, let's say, dx f square, absolute value dl minus 1 of f in x, mu dx, and this is an expectation. Okay, and this is the term, okay, that bounds the Bassel line distance. So we have even reduced the problem even more, because now we had a supremum, we had another supremum which was a simpler one, and now we have just two expectations. Okay, so the problem is now studying this kind of quantity here. It's finished. Because with the light I lost a little track. 2 minutes. Okay. Let me just anticipate there's something. So now, this is the first bound. Now, the second one is, now tomorrow, I will deal with Poisson approximations. Okay? And just to introduce what I'm going to tell you tomorrow, so whenever one deals with Poisson approximations, whenever one deals with normal approximations, one has a guiding light, which is the Bayesian theorem. You try to replicate the Bayesian theorem to find bounds of them. Whenever one deals with Poisson approximations, one is inspired very much by the bounds by Lecam that come from 66. Okay? So we are going to find something that can be interpreted in terms of these bounds by Lecam. And about by Lecam, tell you the following. So suppose that you have a collection xi of independent Bernoulli random variables such that xi has a parameter pi. Okay, now fix capital N, and define, let's say, lambda n is equal to the sum for I going from 1 to capital N of pi, and x capital N to be equal to the sum for I going from 1 to capital N of the xi. Okay, not a very good choice. Let's say capital N hat. Okay, let's say capital N, capital X hat of capital N is the sum of the guys here. And now, one question one can ask is the following. So can we measure the total variation distance between the low of x bar of capital N and the Poisson distribution with parameter lambda n, okay, which is a very natural question. They share the same mean. And of course, there are several regimes in which x bar of capital N converges to a Poisson random variable. Okay, so the bounds by Lecam goes as follows. So it tells you that this is less or equal than, so it will be 1 minus the exponential of lambda n over lambda n. These are not exactly the constants in Lecam paper. They came a little later. And then the sum for I going from 1 up to capital N of pi square, okay? Which is a quite a remarkable result, because it, in a certain sense, anticipated the whole explosion of interest and results in Poisson approximation in the 80s by people like Chen or Barbour or Goldstein, because this sum here is nothing but the difference between the expectation of x bar n and the variance of x bar n. Okay, so this is a typical phenomenon. There is a very famous paper that tells you that 2 moments suffices in many, many occasions for Poisson approximations. Okay, and therefore, we are going to deal with this machinery in order to deduce bounds that have this flavor, okay, in some sense. Okay, they won't have this flavor, but they will have this flavor plus some parasite term. And just to conclude, you will see tomorrow, it's quite an humbling experience to try to have new results in Poisson approximations, because there is a general rule, there is a paper by Andrew Barbour from the 80s that did it better in a more general situation. But, however, our results won't give better rate than the one existing, but allow to shed some light into the structure of Poisson approximations on the Poisson space. Okay, and we will start with the intuition given by this Lecam bounds. Okay. Yeah. Okay, for the discrete distributions, there are a lot of them. That's really something that it's very well developed, and there are a lot of results that go far beyond the Poisson distribution. Concerning continuous distribution, the situation is a little more delicate because one needs. It's a little more delicate because basically, the situation that are best understood are those that concern the Pearson family. Okay, so you have the gamma, uniform, beta. And then outside this, for instance, other families of interest for application, the stable distributions, for instance, are really outside the scope for the moment of the method. Okay, so.
Some of them are potentially related to operators? Or?
Yeah. I mean, there are 2 problems when one wants to develop for a given distribution, the Steins method. One is, first of all, to see the right operator, differential operator. And this already can be tricky, okay? But you can find when you add several operators in a stable case that are good candidates. And then you have to solve the equation in a proper sense. And this is a little more delicate. But people are trying to do this, but I don't know of any good version of the method that applies in this general case. Yeah?
I didn't pay attention for a second, and then lost the... What happened to the f prime of f term?
So okay, so...
Can you say that?
I've write this... So this guy here will be therefore equal to f prime of f dz of f plus a rest that depends on z. And this rest in z will be less or equal in absolute value that 1/2... No, not 1/2. It's 1/2 times the maximum, the bound on F2, so it'll be less or equal than dzf square. Okay? So now I put everything inside here, and I use the fact that F prime is 1, is less than 1, so that's why it disappears. And also F2, because it's less than 2, and it's divided by 1/2, be multiplied by 1/2. So yes, this is the computation, yes. Okay, thank you.
Two words.